This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We all have a picture in our head about what the perfect learning environment looks and sounds like. Secluded, comfortable, quiet. Yeah, that's pretty much all wrong.
It turns out none of those are true. There is no one ideal way to learn.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of the book, How We Learn, and learn how most of us get it all wrong. We'll also head to L.A. to hear how the schools are helping low-income students get 3 solids a day. And we'll spend an academic minute being reminded that sometimes the things we remember are all wrong. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Just about everything you know about learning is wrong. That's the big takeaway from Benedict Carey's book, How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. Carey is a science reporter for the New York Times who focuses on topics concerning the brain and behavior. We recently spoke about the book, which has just been released in paperback. I loved the first line of the review that Scientific American Mind gave your book, saying it was a gift to guilt-ridden slackers everywhere. Thank you for that gift.
My pleasure. I loved that review.
You make it clear early on that the science of learning is not figured out, and you didn't even try, but you've got some pretty good starting points here. Why did you start to hit this topic?
Well, my job is as a reporter on psychology and psychiatry and brain science, and one of the big areas of psychology is cognitive psychology, which is the study of learning and memory, essentially, learning, memory, and thinking. I began to write stories about this field, which does some really interesting direct studies of, you know, what kinds of things affect learning and memory. Simple things, like where you are and if you're moving around or sitting still, the way you engage the material, you know, how you work with it, all sorts of stuff. And I realized that not many people knew this stuff, so I thought it would make a great book.
And one of the main tenets of it is that forgetting is almost as important as learning. Is learning to remember more important than actually learning?
It's a combination of things. Forgetting, it turns out, is very important to learning in that when we learn new stuff, we sort of move into the background some of the things that we already know. So if we couldn't do that, we couldn't learn, you know, the new material. But that doesn't go away. It's still accessible. And so if we need it again, we're able through, you know, several techniques that I describe in here sort of to get it back. But if you can't forget things, if you can't essentially suppress particularly related memories, you can't learn anything new. your brain doesn't have, you can only access a certain finite amount of information at any one time.
You also take that old theory about you need a nice, quiet place to study with no distractions and pretty much blow that up in the book.
That's right. That's sort of folk wisdom, and it seems self-evident that a quiet place and a study ritual, avoiding distractions, all those things would be important to learning. It turns out none of those are true. There is no one ideal way to learn. In fact, the brain kind of grew up, sort of evolutionarily speaking, learning on the fly, you know, out in the open, not in a classroom. And so the trick is to kind of exploit some of those scavenging habits that are really more natural than the very sort of disciplined monk-like ideal that's held up.
Those distractions are almost natural. Now, in the book, you have a little a scene where you had to go finish a newspaper story and you took your young daughter with you, and she observed you doing your work. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did. I brought her into the office on a weekend. You know, the two of us were the only ones here. And I set her down at a computer thinking she would, you know, hop online and get busy. And it looks like it's exactly what she did. And I went to finish a story, and I went into deep concentration, or so I thought. And it was only afterwards, after about an hour and a half or so, that I finished. And I tapped her on the shoulder, and she handed me what was a second-by-second record that she'd been typing of my behavior. And there were a whole lot of things in there, Bob, that I didn't remember doing. I called a friend. I went up and made coffee. You know, I was pulling out stuff from the drawers. I was walking around, sort of mumbling to myself. I thought I'd been concentrating the whole time. And so it was a good illustration of just the principle that, you know, concentration was held up as this kind of, again, an ideal of learning, does not necessarily look like what we think it does. Even when we're very highly concentrated, we are also kind of giving ourselves breaks, and we can be very restless looking to an outside person. So it's just a kind of a demonstration that some of the assumptions we make about ideal learning circumstances aren't based in reality.
And learning is pretty much like that. As you say in the book, your brain really needs those breaks from learning to actually learn.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's one thing if you're jumping on the phone and, you know, Snapchatting, you know, all the way through a college lecture or a, you know, high school lecture. I mean, you're not going to retain anything. Obviously, that's a problem. But to the extent that you're taking distractions when you need a break from something you're working on that does not require continuous attention, you know, like a math problem, or you're doing a term paper, those can help you out. And it's not just because you're getting a break or a rest so much as that the brain works offline on a lot of these problems. And particularly when you're stuck, distraction allows you to, in effect, forget some of the, you know, assumptions you made that blocked you the first time through. And the result is that, you know, when you come back, it's not a matter necessarily of being more rested, but that, you know, you've let go of some bad assumptions and you're able to take a sort of a fresh look at the problem.
And sometimes you say you're learning and you're not even realizing it at the time. Your brain just seems to be working in the background.
That's right. In the example I just gave you there, there is a lot of evidence that that's precisely what's happening, that it is working on the problem essentially without you consciously looking over its shoulder. The brain is reorganizing the material in new ways outside your consciousness. So, you know, when you come back to directly look at the problem, in effect, mentally, the representation of the problem has changed, and you've increased the likelihood you can solve it.
You write about the work of Graham Wallace in the book. Why was his work, do you feel that was important?
Yeah, Graham Wallace was an interesting character. He's an English sort of early 20th century theorist and teacher, education policy person. Famous socialist too. Anyway, he was the first one, Bob, who really provided, you know, the language, the vocabulary to talk about stages of thinking, and particularly problem solving. And it was his language, and particularly his identification of something called incubation, which is that downtime period between, you know, when you're stuck on a problem and when you say, oh God, you know, I see it now, that really launched a bunch of really interesting study into just that process. You know, what's going on? What makes it more likely to happen? And, you know, how can it be used by people? You know, how can you take advantage of it? That kind of thing.
You talk about the importance of sleep, calling it learning with your eyes closed. How important is sleep?
Sleep is very important to learning. I think people suspect this. They maybe know this. We all have instincts about these things. But it's a more interesting story than it looks. Sleep is, at least in one very sort of leading theory, is all about learning consolidation. And that just means that, you know, we see and hear and study a lot of things over the course of a day, way more than we're going to hang on to. And a primary function of sleep is to flag the stuff that's meaningful and hold on to it and get rid of the rest. So 99.9 of the sort of 9% of what we see and hear, what comes through our senses is discarded. And during sleep, according to this theory, you hang on to the good stuff, essentially. And so that's very important in learning. It means not only that sleep is important, but that sleep timing is pretty important. And I can tell you about that, too. But, you know, we sometimes think of sleep as almost a sign of weakness, that we're giving up on studying or working out. And it turns out that's just opposite the case. It finishes the job of learning.
Well, we all know that, you know, waking up at 3 in the morning going, ah, that's what I was trying to remember.
Yeah, but it's more even than that. In fact, the study of sleep and learning has found, for example, that the first half of a night's sleep, a normal night's sleep, now that might be for you, you know, going to bed at 10 and getting up at 7, I don't know, but the first half of the sleep is rich in what's called deep sleep, and that's important for retention, straight retention. So if you don't get that first half of the night's sleep, your retention level goes down. Okay, so that's important information if you're preparing, for example, for a French test or an Arabic test, for a test where you really are going to be assessed on your ability to recall, straight recall. You need to get that first half of your normal night's sleep and not cut into it. So you can see that, for example, that in this example, that staying up late is not a particularly good idea because you are biting a piece off of the retention consolidation part of sleep. So for an exam like that, you should go to bed the normal time, and if you're going to shorten your night, you should get up early and prepare. So that's an example, Bob, of how the study can kind of help you be tactical in the way that you use your study time.
Still to come, our conversation with New York Times science reporter Ben Carey about his book, How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens, continues with a look at some puzzles and problems he put through the book. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Benedict Carey, a science reporter for The New York Times. We're talking about his book, How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. I did want to let you know that I did feel very good about myself when I figured out the pencil problem.
Did you?
I did. Oh, yes. Didn't take all that long.
That is a great problem, and it's an old problem. Yeah, and so the book's got a few of those, and they're good demonstrations, I think, of the way that some of this incubation time can work in your favor, offline thinking while you're being distracted.
Well, incubation, I thought was one of the better things that you brought up in the book because of, you mentioned some people get their ideas in the toilet. I get them in the shower. Man, we all get these ideas when we're really not even trying to come up with them.
That's right, and I think the reason is, as I mentioned before, that a lot of the times when you're stuck, what's happened is not so much, you're not smart enough to handle the problem, but that you've made assumptions about the solution without knowing you've made those assumptions. The example I give in the book is there's a joke or a puzzle or riddle. You can still get people stuck on this. There's a doctor in Chicago who has a brother who's a doctor in Boston, but the doctor in Boston does not have a brother. How can that be? And that was the joke or a puzzle sort of told more often in my parents' day. And, of course, the one in Chicago is a female doctor. But you can trick people with that by saying fiddler, boxer, whatever, today. And the point there is not that, you or I aren't capable of seeing a solution. It's that our brains have made an assumption in that particular puzzle before we even know it. And that is, you say fiddler or boxer, and the picture that comes into your head is male. And so that's what makes that a puzzle. And so what incubation is describing, that is, you're distracted, you're offline, you're doing something else. Your brain hasn't let go of the problems, but it is able to let go of some of those assumptions. So it's once you do that that you really sort of see a much clearer way to a solution. That's the idea behind distraction as a tool to increase the likelihood of seeing a solution.
There's an awful lot of great information in this book. What can teachers do with this to make their job a little easier or a little more effective?
Well, teaching and learning are two different things, and they do overlap, of course, and I think teachers have really good instincts about a lot of this stuff. But I'll tell you what, I think the best way to use this material is to teach it directly. The classroom situations are very different from individual learning situations. Teachers know this too well. And so you can't really tailor this information necessarily to every single classroom. But you can teach the techniques directly to kids. In fact, that makes for a really interesting and useful brain science class. My sort of shtick on this now, Bob, is to say, let's just teach it directly for now. Schools already teach some organizational skills and how to be a student. This is a perfect place to teach direct the science of learning, and sort of learning 101, call it what you like. But teachers and schools will incorporate some of these things, and they already are. But some of them will not incorporate to classrooms easily. These are individual learning techniques, and as I say, they should be taught directly, and kids, I think, can have a lot of fun with them. Once you know them, it makes a lot of studying or preparing or practicing. It can make it much less dreary than it is.
so it can make life easier for students, if not teachers.
For sure. I mean, the first thing it does is it takes stress out of trying to live up to an ideal student because, you know, it ain't ideal, not the one description we've been given. But it also, more importantly, I think for students of all kinds and all ages, and this applies to all ages, it gives you a way to make a strategy. You know, you can take the science of learning, Learning 101. There's about 10 different techniques, and you can choose the ones that apply to, you know, the material you're trying to learn a particular week or month or whatever it is. I mean, you do certain things preparing for language tests, and you do other things for math tests, and still other things preparing for, let's say, a recital or even, for that matter, you know, a soccer game. So we never get techniques. No one ever gets Learning 101 as a class. We grow up just hoping we're doing it right. What this science does is give you, at least give you some idea of how to approach learning particular material, how to use your time. So I think it's powerful stuff.
You close the book with the 11 essential questions. First of all, why 11? And second of all, are these is this kind of the sum of what you're trying to get out to people?
Yes, I put 11 questions. I don't, the number of questions itself is meaningless. I don't know. It just came out to be 11. I wanted to cover in those 11 questions some very central points in the book, but also use them as a teaser for people to, you know, wonder why, for example, distractions can help in some situations, or wonder why in some situations the more we get tested, the better we do, even though we haven't restudied. Right? Or wonder why highlighting, which is something I did, I'm sure you did, so many of us did, is not a good idea, is not a good study technique. In fact, can get in the way and be a limiting thing. So a lot of the techniques found in this science are counterintuitive, and those 11 questions kind of are fun to do. They're multiple choice, and also I think make people wonder, well, why would this be true? Why would these things be kind of the opposite of what I expect? And once you see the science, it's pretty straightforward.
Again, the name of Ben Carey's book is How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. It's just been released in paperback from Random House. Almost 20% of the people in Los Angeles County live in poverty, and the majority of these households have children. The Los Angeles United School District hopes to combat the students' hunger by providing free dinner. Diamond Nagasu is a student who spoke with some adults as well as fellow students to see how they feel about this program.
The Los Angeles Unified School District, or LAUSD, has a new idea. Dinner. My name is Diamond Nagasu, and I'm a senior at Palos Verdes High School in Southern California. This beachside community gazes upon the Pacific Ocean, and because of that pristine view, exorbitant real estate prices arise, making it an upper-middle-class community. However, less than 10 minutes away from my house, 80% of the students in LAUSD are living at or below the poverty line. I really can't imagine trying to concentrate through a long school day with a growling stomach, let alone knowing I'll do it every single day. So I spoke with some LAUSD elementary and middle school students about where they get their meals and how the addition of getting dinner at school would affect them.
Do you eat breakfast at home before going to school?
No, I eat here.
I eat breakfast at school Monday through Friday.
I'm hungry, before I go to school.
Who makes your meals?
The cafeteria?
The cafeteria here at our school, they set up lunch, breakfast, and snack for us.
We have a lot of kids on free meals. Breakfast is for everyone in our entire district. Some of them do get free lunch and just eat whatever they can.
Are you ever hungry at school?
Almost every day. And when we do math, I kind of get hungry.
And how does it affect your studies, when you're hungry in class?
Distracting. Not allowing myself to concentrate more often.
I focus so much on trying to find food that sometimes I kind of don't focus on the lesson.
I'll be focusing on when I'm going to be able to eat.
I too have been hungry at school, but at least I know exactly when I'll have food next. Maybe even a small meal at 3:30, depending on my schedule for the night. However, these kids have already established a very different after-school routine.
I normally get home at 5:45.
At 6.
Like at 6.
I'll say about 6:20.
At 5:45.
At 6.
How would you feel if they started serving dinner at school?
I would feel happy.
I would feel great if that were to happen. I would feel excited.
I could feel much better without thinking about it.
That would help my mom. She wouldn't have to cook dinner and pick us up, bring us back up, because she has 5 kids, you know, so when we come home, we already have full stomachs, you know, we can work on homework.
Seeing these kids light up was amazing when I talked to them about the prospect of dinner. But not everyone seemed to like this program.
Free dinners, really? I mean, I don't want to say if you can't afford, kids don't have them, but...
I think 2 meals is sufficient, but then, I don't know. I really think the parents should be responsible.
That was an LAUSD staff member, as well as a PV mom. I was surprised that with such different backgrounds, both women had similar outlooks. Confused, I asked a PV mom about her children's eating habits.
I would never let my kids leave the house with an empty stomach.
Could you imagine your children hungry?
No. That will break my heart.
Are you ever hungry during the weekend?
Yes.
Most of the time, yeah.
Sometimes when we run out of food and my mom like forgets to go grocery shopping or when they're not home, yeah, sometimes we do get hungry.
In 2014, LAUSD served dinner to 75,000 out of their 600,000 students, and they plan to double that number in the next 2 years. I think that's a great idea.
Diamond Nagasiu is a high school senior from Los Angeles County, California. Earlier, we heard about how remembering what you forgot is an important part of learning, but what if you're remembering wrong? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How sharp is your memory? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Jennifer Tallarico, associate professor of psychology at Lafayette College, shows how our memories might not be as accurate as we think.
I'd like you to remember the last time you ate dinner at a restaurant. Were you able to see the scene, maybe recreate the taste of the meal, or hear the sound of your dining partner's laugh? These details allow you to re-experience the event while remembering it. But how do you know that the details you are retrieving are accurate? We're usually willing to admit we might be leaving out some details or forgetting, but we're usually less aware when we are introducing new details or when we might be confusing details from one event with those of a similar event. These are not conscious lies that we tell ourselves, but rather the natural result of the way that our mind recreates the past. Remembering is much more like staging a play than showing a film. Think about that dinner again. You likely didn't pay much attention to the floor at the time, yet your memory included some kind of carpet or wood flooring. As we experience the world, we build representations of what events are typically like, and we then rely on those representations to help fill in the blanks when we recall specific events. Most of the time, most components of our memories are mostly accurate. But if you've ever had a disagreement with a spouse or a sibling about what happened at a particular event in the past, you know that although you both believe you're remembering the event correctly, one of you must be wrong. The subjective sense of confidence in our own memories is often at odds with objective accuracy. And this is true even when the event in question is more important or more emotional than a simple restaurant dinner. For example, my colleagues and I have shown that even though we all believe we know exactly where we were and what we were doing when we learned of the September 11th attacks, many of our memories have changed over the years such that what we remember now is different from what we recalled then. So in the future, remember that remembering isn't perfect.
That was Jennifer Tallarico of Lafayette College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.